The American POTUS Podcast is a 501c3 nonprofit show supported by listener patriots just like you. To help us keep the program going, please join others around the nation by considering a tax-deductible donation. You can make your contribution and see what exciting plans we have for new podcasts and other outreach programs at AmericanPOTUS.org. Thank you for your support, and we hope you enjoy this episode. Coming up on American POTUS, Richard Nixon. The Watergate cover-up and the resignation. To this day, they are the first things we remember when it comes to our 37th POTUS. But take away the emotional preconceived notions, and what do we discover? A man with a modest background, a complicated personality, and a drive to succeed that was off the charts. Leave what you thought about Dick Nixon aside and consider our objective look at this president, all he accomplished while in office, and how he changed American politics forever, both good and bad. That's on this episode of American POTUS. I'm Scott Brun. With the help of presidential scholar Alan Lowe, we're opening the book on the men who have held our nation's highest office. By sharing their challenges, their stories, and their personalities, we hope to add some clarity and perspective for today's heated political conversations. We want to know more about our 37th POTUS, and there are few better to offer an insightful and balanced perspective than award-winning author and previous guest of this podcast, Evan Thomas. In addition to writing several insightful books about our nation's complicated history, he's also taught writing and journalism at Harvard and Princeton, and appeared on a whole host of different radio and TV talk shows through the years. It's his New York Times bestseller, Being Nixon, A Man Divided, that we want to get into today to help us understand one of our most controversial presidents. If you're interested in this title, we'll have a link on AmericanPOTUS.org. Evan, we understand you're babysitting grandchildren, so thank you for taking a break and stopping by. Welcome back to American POTUS.
I'm glad to have a break. It's easier to talk about Nixon than take care of four-year-olds.
Evan, always great to talk with you. You know, I'm a big fan of all your work, and that includes Being Nixon. Such a really insightful book. Today, we're going to touch on some of the key issues you raised, some of the key times in Nixon's life, but out of, you know, just because of time, we can't talk about everything. We necessarily will skip a lot. So I encourage our listeners to go out and get Being Nixon if you don't already have that. So with that, let's take a brief look at Nixon's youth. Now, you state early on in the book that Richard learned to see that crisis was normal, that rejection was to be reversed, if not avenged, and that he craved order. Why do you think those attitudes developed during his youth, and how were they manifested in those early years?
Well, you know, all life is high school, and we all know what it's like to be insecure at high school. But Nixon had a way of getting even, and some of it was just vengeful, but some of it was very politically astute. And he realized in high school and really in college that just because you're not one of the popular kids, one of the cool kids, doesn't mean you can't have power. And the way he realized that was he went to a college called Whittier in California. And there was, as there is, you know, in most colleges, an elite fraternity called the Franklins. And Nixon said, you know, those guys, they're the cool guys, but there are more uncool people in college than cool people. And he saw it as a political base. And particularly, this is a college in the Depression, a lot of poor kids. And the big issue, which he ran on for student body president, was dancing. Dancing at Whittier. Whittier was a religious school, a Quaker school, no dancing. And Nixon ran on a platform of bringing dancing to Whittier, not because he could dance. Nixon hated to dance, but because the rich kids could go off and go to nightclubs and go dancing. But the poor kids could not. They needed to be able to dance on campus. There were more poor kids than rich kids at Whittier in 1931. It's the Great Depression. And Nixon was swept into office on this platform. Classic Nixon. He was a populist before we even understood the word as it's used today. He had a way of making people resent the elites and vote their own interests to sort of knock off. He had a chip on his shoulder, you know, and he knew that other people had a chip on their shoulder, and to vote to run against the elites as the tribune or as the guy who's running for the ordinary man, for the forgotten man, for the regular guy. That was his formula, and he used it for the rest of his life.
He jumped into the public arena early then in college. And I remember you also wrote that he performed in plays and that type of thing, but he had an innate shyness. How did he balance that introverted nature with the extroverted career he chose?
By doing the work. He was very shy and awkward, and it was painful for him, but he compensated for it by remembering stuff. When he was a politician, young politician, he would make, 3x5 cards, and he had a note card on everybody, and he could remember who your cousin was or whether your aunt was sick or what you wanted, and people are flattered by that. He remembered you and what you wanted and what you needed, and he kept track of it. And that is the key to being an effective politician. So he didn't have a good glad-handing manner. He was awkward and he was clumsy and he said the wrong thing, but he really did the work of finding out about you. And that's caring about you. And he showed that he cared by remembering you.
Well, he goes on from Whittier to Duke and gets his law degree. He serves in World War II in the Navy and then was elected to Congress and first really became famous there due to the Hiss affair. Can you remind us of the outlines of that story and how it affected his political career going forward?
Well, you have to, after World War II, there was a great fear of communist spies because we just won World War II, but here we were already in a Cold War against communist Russia. And there was a great fear in the United States of spies. Well, he was on a congressional committee that was looking into this, not very successfully, but he latched onto this guy named Alger Hiss. And the key thing of Alger Hiss was he was a fancy Harvard Law School lawyer. And all the elites thought that this guy was above reproach. He couldn't possibly be a communist because he'd gone to Harvard Law School and he was friends with a lot of fancy people in Washington. And Nixon dug into it and found out that Hiss was, in fact, a spy, was a Russian spy. And he, by revealing this and exposing Hiss, he really made a name for himself, Nixon did, as a communist hunter, as somebody who could fight back against the communists. And he exaggerated it, but Hiss was a spy. He wasn't wrong about that. And it gave him an instant celebrity.
And it also put an instant target on him for the left.
It sure did, because a lot of people were resentful that Nixon did this. He made them look foolish. People like Dean Acheson, the Secretary of State, who was a friend of Alger Hiss's, Nixon made him look dumb. And the liberal publications, the New York Times, the New Republic, they thought that Nixon was kind of a low-rent guy. Now, they weren't all wrong about that. Nixon could play dirty and could play rough, at least. So, and he was, he did have a chip on his shoulder. So it's not that the left-wing press was all wrong about Nixon, but they exaggerated his faults, and they ended up fueling Nixon's desire for revenge. And Nixon was very skillful at running against them.
Let's talk about that image from the very beginning, from his first campaign. He was tainted with that image of being Tricky Dick. Was that image accurate? And was it accurate throughout his career? Did it change throughout his career?
It's exaggerated. He was made out to be worse than he was, but he had a pretty clever campaign consultant who knew how to play hard and play rough. He didn't lie, cheat, and steal, but he sort of pushed the edge. And he would exaggerate the degree to which his opponents were lefties. He would make them further left or more red, as we used to say, more communist than they actually were. So he would exaggerate the truth. And out of that, he got this nickname, Tricky Dick, and the nickname stuck. And there was some truth to it.
Well, we know after service in the House and the Senate, he's chosen to be Ike's vice presidential running mate. And in the middle of that, there's a major scandal. Can you remind us of the story of the Checker speech and what long-term impact it had on both Nixon and how he was viewed by that growing set of detractors?
So this is a classic Nixon story because he was caught up in a scandal where it looked like he had a slush fund and that he was corrupt. It was an unfair charge. The slush fund was no bigger than actually Adlai Stevenson had. It was not used for his political benefit. It was used for politics. But he was pinned with it, and the left press went after him. And he gave a famous speech. He bought time. And interestingly, President Eisenhower tried to dump him from the ticket. I mean, it was that bad. But Nixon insisted on going on national television to defend himself. And he gave something called the Checker speech, which was based on the idea that he had this dog named Checkers and he'd given by a campaign contributor and his kids loved it. And he wasn't going to give back the dog Checkers. And it was a kind of lachrymose, maudlin speak. And it turned off a lot of people. But a lot of people felt sympathetic to Nixon, that he was getting screwed by by the elites again. And, you know, it actually was a very successful speech. It was early days of TV. This is 1952. TV was in its infancy, but he reached a lot of people. And Eisenhower had to keep him on the ticket. And it was a lesson for Nixon that you can go over the heads of the elite once more and appeal to the common man and survive. Not only survive, but prosper.
Amazingly, he even went over the head of Eisenhower.
Yes. I mean, Ike was going to dump him from the ticket because Ike's lieutenants told him, hey, this guy's too damaged. You need to get rid of him. But Nixon, in his defiant way, he was speaking to him. I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on this thing, but he said, Nixon, Eisenhower was being indecisive. Mm-hmm. And Nixon said to him, either S-H-I-T or get off the pot.
Yeah.
A crude expression, to right. put it mildly. But the point was, you know, you got to decide here. And Eisenhower couldn't decide. Nixon went on TV, saved himself. And Eisenhower said, okay, buddy, you're my man. You can stay.
So you mentioned earlier that from the very beginning of his political career in college as student body president, he brought together kind of the uncool kids. He was hated by the so-called Georgetown set in Washington, and he returned the feeling. What explains that mutual hatred that later was part of his downfall?
Well, the Georgetown set was unfair to Nixon. I used to work for the Washington Post Company for Katharine Graham, so I knew these people, and you might say that I'm one of them. But they looked down on Nixon, partly because he had bad manners and because he was uncouth and uncool. Didn't really fit in. All the way back to college, he was not a Franklin. He was not one of the cool guys. And the Georgetown set, well, they were the cool guys. And so they kind of looked down their nose at him and embarrassed him. And he was bitter and angry about it and thought it was unfair. He was not wrong about that and wanted to get even. And he did get even. After all, he was elected president of the United States by, I believe, this in 1972, the second largest margin in history majority. Only after, I believe, LBJ in 64. And so he did get his revenge, but those ghosts haunted him. His desire to get even, and specifically in 1960 when he ran against John F. Kennedy, he believed correctly that Kennedy was cheating. He believed that Kennedy stole the 1960 election. You can make a pretty good case that Kennedy did, certainly in the state of Illinois, stealing the Chicago vote. There's a new book by Irv Gelman, which makes a pretty good case that Kennedy stole the 60 election and that Nixon did the statesmanlike thing. Nixon was the vice president and did not contest it. He accepted the outcome, even though he knew it was unfair. He accepted it. But unfortunately, the bitterness kind of lodged in his heart. And he said, Kennedy used dirty tricks against me. I'm never going to let that happen again. So when he's elected president in 68, he's determined that the Democrats are never going to beat him with dirty tricks. He's going to outdo them. And that's the beginning of Watergate. That's where the evil seed is planted, where he lets his subordinates, he gives them too much rope. And the atmosphere at the White House is, you know, you can play dirty because that's just politics. And they started to play too dirty. Now, it's important to say that Nixon never knew about the Watergate break-in before it happened. Nixon did not order the Watergate break-in. He didn't even know about it. But he was complicit in the cover-up. And he did break laws in the cover-up. And so the point is, he created an atmosphere at the White House where people did illegal things like break into the Watergate, which Nixon may not have known about. But when they got caught, he did participate in the cover-up. And so he was impeached, and fairly so, and rightly so. He did break the law.
Why do you think after he learned of the break-in, he didn't fire the leading officials involved and come clean?
That's a great historical question. Because the Watergate break-in is June of 1972. Nixon was running against George McGovern, and Nixon was about 30 points ahead. He was going to beat McGovern even if he, you know, proverbially ran naked down the street. The point is, Nixon could have fired John Mitchell, his head of the election committee. He could have cleaned house, and he still would have won. He might not have won by 30 points, but he won comfortably as it was. He still would have won. His problem was he didn't clean house. He didn't face up to it in real time. Instead, he continued to cover up, and that's what undid him.
Did he think it would just be fodder for his enemies, or was he overly loyal? What do you think were the motivations? I know it's hard to get
into that. Well, that's also a good question. Part of it is loyalty. He felt he really liked Attorney General Mitchell, who no longer the Attorney General, who's head of his campaign committee. But John Mitchell had been as sort of the grown-up in the room, a big advisor to him. And he knew that Mitchell was having personal problems with his wife, Martha Mitchell. And Nixon was sympathetic to him and didn't want to throw him out. Nixon was one of these guys who could be the tough guy, but he also had a shy and insecure side. He did not like confrontation. He did not like saying no. He did not like firing his subordinates. And so he was unable to step up to it and get rid of the bad actors, partly because he was sympathetic to them, partly because he was weak, and partly, unfortunately, because he was also a congenital liar, and he just couldn't face the truth. And although for all those reasons, good and bad, it caught up with him in a terrible way.
Let's step back in time a bit to the 68 election when he's first elected president, probably the greatest political comeback in American history. What were the steps he took to make that possible after the devastating loss in 1960?
Well, he was a very shrewd politician. And in 1968, he quickly realized that he could get the Republican nomination by being the candidate of the middle of the, oddly, of the establishment. I know this sounds odd in light of everything I've said, but he was a smart guy, and he positioned himself as the moderate running between the Democrats to the left, McGovern, and the Democratic Party had become pretty liberal by 1968, and on the right, George Wallace, the governor of Alabama, who was running for the Democratic nomination, but running with a sort of a racist working class, but also kind of dangerous, almost revolutionary side to him. And Nixon was as the guy in the middle, posing as the kind of return to normalcy. The left was scary because this is 1968. There are race riots. King is assassinated. Kennedy's assassinated. Vietnam is getting worse. The campuses are blowing up. Nixon is, hey, let's moderate. Let's pull back from that. But let's not go all the way over to these right-wing nuts with George Wallace, who is outward racist and wants to bring back segregation. Nixon was able to position himself as somewhat in the middle, to the right of center, but more moderate than not. And that was a winning formula.
And certainly Humphrey comes out of a Democratic National Convention that is just chaotic in Chicago.
Well, the Democratic Party was pretty liberal by then. And that's labor. Humphrey had a big labor backing. Nixon was able to both be friendly to some labor unions, but also in opposition to labor going too far to the left. Nixon was good at finding the seam, if you will, the kind of middle ground of think of a quarterback who's picking apart his own defense. That was Nixon. He could throw into the zone and find the seam.
That silent majority, that's the phrase he came up with.
He coined it. That's a word he coined. And the notion was the silent majority was, this is 68, everything's blowing up. He correctly saw that most Americans weren't on either the left side of the left or the right, that they wanted to quiet things down. They were scared of the race riots. They were scared of the racial tension. They wanted to calm things down. They weren't racist, but they didn't love black power either. And they were not necessarily for the Vietnam War, but they didn't like the crazy college kids on campus shutting campuses down. That riots, that was scary stuff. The silent majority that was silent, that was not protesting, that was the majority. And Nixon knew how to find it.
And you note that during his presidency, he does a whole host of, particularly in domestic policy, of initiatives that could be labeled liberal or conservative. So it's very hard to put a pin on him in terms of what he is politically.
He dealt with political reality. Political reality in 1969, 1970 was that Congress was controlled by Democrats. And he, and to his credit, he was willing to work with Congress. And he also had a very clever way of outflanking his opposition. So that, for instance, in 1971, it looked like the lead candidate, possibly, for the Democratic nomination in 1972, this is in 1970, 1971, was Ed Muskie of Maine. Muskie was an environmentalist, and Nixon outflanked him by being more of an environmentalist. I mean, it's ironic, but the guy who created the Environmental Protection Agency was Richard Nixon. That was partly a political move, not so much because Nixon was an environmentalist, although he wasn't, he had a mixed record on that, but because he wanted to outflank, outfox, fake out Ed Muskie by going to the left of him on the environment. And that environment, that worked. I don't want to make it sound just cynical politics. Nixon understood how Washington worked. He understood how to get things done. Unlike to politics today, where kind of nothing gets done and Congress is just paralyzed, Nixon was able to work with the other side of the aisle, as they say, and get things done. And you can look at his legislative record. It's actually pretty impressive.
It's also impressive when you look at his foreign policy. And of course, that was his first love. That came up early in his political career. A lot of focus put on foreign policy. Looking at his most historic success, what do you think led to his revolutionary outreach to China?
Well, Nixon liked to pretend that he was not an intellectual, but he was. He read philosophers. He read biography. He liked to say, "I don't want to have any Harvard people." Or I was against Harvard, but his national security advisor was a Harvard professor. His attorney general went to Harvard. I mean, so you had to listen. With Nixon, was important, as John Mitchell said, watch what we do, not what we say. So Nixon was actually pretty intellectual, and he studied up on foreign affairs, and he realized that the United States was entering a world where it wasn't just going to be the United States on top or just two nations, more multipolar, as they said, the academics say, and that China was going to be a rising power. And he, even though China was isolated, it was a vast country. And so he did the unthinkable, or the hard to believe. He reached out to China, which had been isolated from the West for a couple of decades. And famously, Nixon went to China. He literally went to China. And he was clever about trying to side with the Chinese against the Russians. He saw that it was better to split the communists, split the Russians from the Chinese, and at least have relationships with China to pull them away from Russia, to exploit what he could see was a gap growing between Russia and China. And it had the effect of bringing China into the world. And for a long time, that was a really good thing for the whole world. When China entered the world and became a big commercial power, free trade and global trade and globalization, everybody, all boats rose, including Chinese boats and also American boats. Now, today, the world is more complicated. But when Nixon did this in the early 70s, this was a brilliant move. And only Nixon could do it because, remember, he was a big communist hunter. Only the guy who'd gone after Alger Hiss could say, "I'm going to go meet with those communists." And thus was born the phrase, like Nixon going to China. It's become a cliche now. When you do something that seems completely contrary to your background, but is a brilliant political move, that's Nixon going to China. And it really, it helped the whole world. Now, you could argue that China is too powerful now and new Cold War. That's years later. But at the time, it was a very smart move and a move that was good for the world, for the United States and the world.
So after a very consequential presidency that ends in tragedy, the tragedy of Watergate, after his resignation, what do you think explains Nixon's continued popularity here, around the world, and his desire to be back on that stage?
Well, Nixon, to his credit, was a fighter who never gave up. And yes, he was badly wounded by Watergate. He almost died. He was sick. He had phlebitis, and he was just a wreck. And he was physically ill, but he got up. He wasn't dead, and he was a fighter. He got back, and he reinserted himself into the international scene. He began advising presidents. He started sending memos to presidents, to Reagan. And by the time of Bill Clinton valued Nixon as an advisor on Russia. Nixon was the only president to go to Moscow. Nixon personally negotiated an arms control treaty by going to Moscow himself. No other American president had done that. Talk about going to the enemy. Nixon went there himself. And he had an expertise on Russia. He had met with Brezhnev and he'd met with the Russians that later presidents, Bill Clinton and Reagan, but then Clinton, needed and used. And they called on Nixon. So Nixon made himself important again in the game. I wouldn't say he's popular today, but a lot of people certainly know who he was, partly because of his notoriety, because of Watergate, and because he's, frankly, because he's just a weird guy. He doesn't fit normally into your idea. I mean, how can it be that somebody that insecure and uncomfortable and socially awkward was such a successful politician? He was on, five national tickets? He won four times. I don't think any American politician has done that. And yet he was that guy in high school, you remember, was kind of obnoxious and difficult and a loner and, you know, unpopular. And yet, because he was tough and because he was smart and because he did his homework, he clawed back from nothing and made it to the heights before he fell again because his own insecurities brought him down.
And post-presidency, he wrote a lot of books as well.
He did. This is sort of an interesting Nixon thing. He didn't want to take speaking fees, or he didn't want to get in bed with lobbyists. So he tried to make money by writing books. And he wrote a lot of them, foreign policy books, and they sold pretty well. And they kept him in the game. They kept him in the conversation.
Now, the subtitle of your book is A Man Divided. So can you tell us about, as you researched Nixon, some of those contradictions you found in his personality and how they mixed together?
The tragic one was Nixon believed in public service. He's devoted his life to public service. He venerated public service. He read about public servants. But nobody did more to destroy faith in government than Nixon. Think of how he undermined credibility in government and the presidency and the federal government by Watergate. That was a big turnoff. You look at the opinion polls in the 1960s, people believed in government. They lost faith in Vietnam with LBJ, the credibility gap. That started the downward slide. But it was Nixon and Watergate that really made people lose faith in democratic institutions. You can see this in the polling data. And that's a terrible irony when you consider what a good public servant Nixon was for most of his career, that he could then destroy trust in government. It's heartbreaking. And that's because of this essential contradiction in Nixon, which was that he was a hardworking, smart, clever pal, but he was haunted by insecurity, he just couldn't get over his, you know, he said, this is so ironic, and it's out of Shakespeare, when he was leaving the White House, in his last speech at the White House, in August 1974, when he's out the door, he says, you know, you have to learn not to hate your enemies, because that will destroy you. Well, hello, did he just figure that out? Hating his enemies destroyed Richard Nixon. But his last words as he's going out the door is, don't do it. Don't hate your enemies. It will destroy you. Well, it destroyed Richard Nixon.
All right, Evan, some personal questions for you that might reveal a little more about the personality of Tricky Dick. You ready for these? Here we go.
Yeah, let's go.
I have to ask about Nixon's meeting with Elvis the Pelvis in 1970. Why in the world did Nixon agree to what just might be one of the strangest White House meetings of all time?
Elvis just shows up at the White House gate wanting to be let in, and they don't really know what to do. But Nixon's aides and Nixon himself said, sure, bring him in. And it's not as crazy a meeting as you think. There are marvelous pictures of Elvis all done up in his, you know, crazy Elvis garb, and Nixon in his, you know, uptight suit. And they look as different as can be. You know, Elvis has got his pompadour and Nixon's got short hair. But actually, they had a lot in common. What did they have in common? They really had shared a kind of resentment against the elites and also against hippies. Elvis had been surpassed. This is by 1970, Elvis had been surpassed by, if you might say, hippie music, by, you know, leftist music, by, you know, not old-time rock and roll, but the Beatles with their long hair. And Elvis was on kind of a has-been by then, and he resented this. And Nixon and Elvis was in his own way a patriot. He was pro-American. Everybody else was, the rock and roll guys by 1970 were burning the flag. Nixon was no, let's honor the flag. And Nixon was a patriot. Elvis was a patriot. They got together and they really did have a common bond. Insecure guys who had made it in their own way, who really loved their country, who in a way both represented the forgotten man, the little man, not the elites, not the rich kids, not the flag burners, not the hippies, but the regular Americans. They had that in common.
All right, chess or checkers? I'm guessing he'd like to play checkers over chess, right?
What he really liked to play was poker. He made $10,000 in the service over in the Pacific because he was a smart poker player. $10,000 in 1944 was a lot of money, and he used it to stake his first congressional run.
So to that point, was he super competitive with games and family games and that kind of thing?
He was super competitive when the game mattered. I don't think he cared much about, playing cards, unless as a way to make money, to help himself. He wasn't playing poker for fun. He was playing poker because he wanted to make money. So, he was a gamesman, but for a gamesman of consequence. He wasn't doing, he bowled alone. Famously, those photographs of him bowling. He was not a good athlete. He was a football player, but terrible football player. He was cannon fodder on the third team, getting knocked around. He loved sports, but he was bad at sports. He played golf badly.
Don't we all?
Yeah, right, I do.
So tell us about Pat in the role of First Lady. She's maybe not given as much credit as she deserves, right?
That's another tragedy. You want an insight into Pat Nixon, look at Google. Pat Nixon's funeral, and there's video of Nixon crying, and I don't mean just crying, I mean sobbing. He really loved Pat, and he missed her when she died. He was just brokenhearted, but because he's Nixon, he screwed it up, and he pushed her away. She was a great political advisor to him all through his career and really helpful, but by the time he got to the White House, he just couldn't help himself, and he let Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff, come between them, and Pat got kind of sidelined and pushed into the East Wing, and he stopped talking to her. He stopped listening to her. For instance, she would have told him to burn those tapes, the famous tapes, because she knew that he would sound terrible on the tapes, the profanities. But he wasn't listening to her by then. She was drinking a little bit too much by the time they got to the White House, and she was isolated. So it's a heartbreaking story, really. Their marriage improved after he got out of the White House. They got close again, but they were not close enough when he was president.
All right, here's a what-if question for you. Of the last four Republican presidents, Trump, Bush, and Reagan, who do you think he would best get along with politically?
Well, it's a trick question because the answer is all the above. He had elements of all those. He was like Trump. He was a populist, and he knew how to tap into resentment. But like Reagan, he knew how to play great America. Like both Bushes, though, he also knew how to deal with the other side of the aisle, to deal with Democrats, and knew where the center was. So he had elements of all four. He had most of their good elements. Unfortunately, he also had that insecurity we've been talking about that was a kind of paranoia. Maybe that's too strong a word, but something like paranoia that none of the four you've mentioned suffered from. It's hard to tell with Trump. Trump is a one-off, but Nixon was just had this debilitating inferiority complex.
Yeah. What about personally? Which one would he best get along with?
That's a good question. Personally, maybe Trump. Maybe
interesting.
Trump. Nixon really didn't get along with anybody. His best friend was Bebe Rebozo. Why did they get along? Because they never talked.
That's a good point. Nixon is still so controversial today, almost 50 years after resigning. Why do you think it's so important for today's public to still learn about him and all of our nation's presidents? How can they help us be better citizens and voters today?
Well, Nixon is a lesson in so many ways. The important lesson, the biggest one is don't let your personal insecurities ruin a great thing. That's the tragedy of Nixon, and every school kid can learn from that. But more narrowly, the importance of having an international perspective. Nixon, he was not, although he came from a party that was, Republican Party was kind of isolationist when he started. He was an internationalist and he saw the bigger world. That's an important lesson for America today as then as now, that, we are the indispensable nation in the world. He should be studied for that. Also, his political ability to get himself elected by finding the middle, by finding the silent majority, by finding the forgotten man. Anybody who wants to be a politician should study Dick Nixon, or wants to run for any office, should study how Nixon was a politician. And I think lastly, we should study Nixon because his flaws accent what was good. His tragedy brings forward what was good about him. He did care about public service. He did care about America. Those were good qualities. He undermined them. He destroyed them. But like, you know, we read Greek tragedies, not because they're happy, they have happy endings, but because their very tragedy shows us great underlying truths.
Evan, we love all your books. They're all fascinating. What's next for you? Give us a sneak preview of what's on your to-do list.
I'm just finishing a book about the end of World War II, about dropping the atom bomb. And it is, to me, a fascinating book because it shows, you know, the conventional wisdom has become, well, did we really have to drop those bombs? The answer is, unfortunately, yes, because the Japanese were just not going to surrender. They had a national death wish. And so I'm sorry to say, but those atom bombs were necessary. And also the Russian invasion of declaring war on Japan was necessary. It's a story of men faced with impossible choices where they had to choose the least bad option. Dropping those atom bombs was the least bad option. What would have been worse is continuing the war.
Any idea when it will be coming
next
out?
Year?
Next year.
It should be out next year.
Excellent. Evan, thank you so much for taking the time to stop by American POTUS.
I love talking to you guys. Always glad to do it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the American POTUS podcast. We'd like to thank historian and best-selling author Evan Thomas for joining us to talk about Richard Nixon. More information on all of his terrific books can be found on AmericanPOTUS.org. And we would like to thank all of you that have made a tax-deductible financial contribution to support this podcast. In addition to this show, your generosity helps us develop new groundbreaking podcast shows and revolutionary outreach programs, offering clarity and perspective to today's political conversations. If you'd like to contribute, it's easy. Simply visit AmericanPOTUS.org. We appreciate your help. American POTUS is produced by American History Studios, graphic design by Proudler Design, and original music score by Jonathan Clark Music. Finally, it's our presidential last word from Richard Nixon, quote, "Only if you have been in the deepest valley can you ever know how magnificent it is to be on the highest mountain."